I'll admit, okay, it's not a good thing to do, but it is done all the time. And people are going to do it, so you've got to do something about this. And what we don't want to do is allow someone to just accidentally paste this sort of stuff into IRC. So there's a new development going on. There is one NSA employee who I believe is dedicated full-time, 40 hours a week, to nothing but doing this. The project is called Security Enhanced X, which is a really cool acronym. And this project will provide still not entirely specified X Windows SE Linux functionality. So one of the functionalities will be you'll have clipboard data with a type assigned to it, and this type will determine where you can paste it. So if you copy some data from a privileged window, you can only paste it into another window of the same privilege or better. That means you, and also a low privileged X Windows client program like an IRC client, if it tries to grab a copy of the screen, all it will see is its own window. What you don't want to do is allow an unprivileged program to copy all the windows, because there could be who knows what privileged information on there. Another thing, of course, is you want to greatly restrict access to the keyboard and not allow a process to capture keyboard events when it doesn't have keyboard focus. The exact ways, the details of this are still a bit undefined. They're still sort of working them out. One of the things that they're going to do this is to they're talking about having a user-space implementation of the SE Linux policy engine. And so you have a user-space application with a copy of the policy database the kernel has, and then an interface possibly similar to NetLink used for the kernel to say, hey, I've got a new policy loaded. Your applications now have to get a copy of this from me and do whatever's appropriate for yourself. So this is going to be, this is in development right now, and the details are still a bit undefined. Yes, question there? Okay. The question was, when I said that you've got to have greater than equal privileges for a data to be pasted, does that mean we have a hierarchical relationship? Okay. In general, in SE Linux, there is no hierarchy of domains. The rules mapping domains are all entirely up to the administrator, so there is no compulsion for hierarchy, and there is no support for inheritance. So you can't say, domain B does everything domain A does, but it's a little bit extra, or it's a little bit less. You can't do that. You can write policy macros and import the same sort of stuff yourself, but that's an import macro issue. But in a more general sense, when you're writing the policy, you know there are certain rules. For example, the domain that's used for running Mozilla is not going to be a very privileged domain, and that shouldn't be able to read the regular data from the default domain for your login session. Also, if you run the new role command inside next term and go to administrative role, then other processes running as a default role would ideally be prevented from accessing this window. This means, of course, you need to have some interaction with the extern to know that this is something special here. And that's where it gets really tricky. I'm not sure how much of this functionality the NSA guy is going to develop in regard to externs. There is another thing. I mentioned briefly at the start, multi-level security, MLS. If you use MLS, then within a particular domain, you do have a hierarchy. So you have both categories and ranges of the data. So for each domain, you can have a category. They have, in one of the default policies, they had NATO, UK, some American thing, etc. And then they had different levels, top secret, secret, eyes only, classified, unclassified, stuff like that. And we could have an SE Linux, we could have Security Enhanced X policy, which deals with this, in theory at least, which would require, of course, actually getting multi-level security working properly. But if we did that, then we could have this supporting with Security Enhanced X, and only allow data to go upwards, not downwards. Now, there was another question a couple of rows in front. Yep. Okay, question is, does SE Linux have NIST Plus support? PAM is used for login processes, so if you've got the NIST Plus PAM module, what you would then need is support to allow the login process to make a network connection. And this is, I think, pretty much the same as for LDAP. I think it would have pretty much the same issues. So it would probably, it would not work in default policy right now. You could make I've got a policy module called authnet.te, and that will, that was what I was using at one stage to get LDAP authentication working. It was so ugly, I don't think the NSA guys ever accepted it. But if you use that, then it should work for NIST Plus, sort of. If it doesn't work, it'll be about 5 minutes work to hack it into shape. For a lot of things in SE Linux, the default policy is fairly tight. And so if you do an install and you've got a complicated setup, you'll find that there'll be some things that possibly won't work. And so you've got to change the policy. When you change the policy, there's always a right way to do it and a way that will basically get the job done. So if you want to get NIST Plus going, you can say, okay, I'll add a bunch of rules. This isn't perhaps ideal, but it'll still be 100 times more secure than a default Linux install, so I'm going to be happy with this. And one of the things I'm working on right now for Red Hat is to develop ways of configuring this Linux policy to be less strict. And we know this means that there will be some cases where attacks could take place, but with the current policy, it wouldn't take place. And it'll be a tunable option for the administrator to say when they're configuring SE Linux, which of these options for SE Linux policy do you want to enable? And they can choose options that everyone knows will make the machine slightly less secure. It'll still be a lot more secure than a default Linux install, and this should make you happy. The back. Okay, good question. The question is, what's the difference between admin context and root on a non-SE Linux machine? In the default SE Linux policy at the moment, if you are logged in as the administrative context and as root, independent things, the way SE Linux works is SE Linux checks are performed after regular Unix checks. So if you do chmod 0 on a file and you're not root, you can't read that file, regardless of what SE Linux says. So now, if you're both in administrative role and administrative domain and you're root, then you can do most things. So you can access files in the user's home directory. You can write to files in /etc. One thing you can't do, you can't write to the shadow file. The reason for this is very simple. If you were to run VI on the shadow file, and the version of VI you're using was NVI, NVI, when it recreates a file, will by default create a new file and then rename it to the name of the file you're using. And because NVI has no SE Linux patch, we're talking about doing this now, so I wouldn't be surprised if Fedora Core 2 had a patched NVI to address this issue, but currently NVI doesn't have this patch. So if you were to edit the shadow file with NVI right now on an SE Linux machine, you would relabel the file by accident from shadow underscore T to etc underscore T. And therefore, any user who has UID 0 or GID shadow can read it. If you're running a traditional Unix setup, which means only administrators have root, then this might not be too bad. One way you can use SE Linux is to have root still being an administrative account, and SE Linux will just make it a lot harder to get UID 0. If they have UID 0 then, and your shadow file isn't labeled, then they can read the shadow file and it's game over. But usually this will be hard to do. So in some situations, I guess it might make sense to just not bother about that. For a really secure system though, or for a SE Linux play machine, like I'm doing with machines with public root access, you need to have the shadow file have the right label, and that means you need to prevent the administrator from accidentally going the wrong command. So they run VIPW, VIPW runs in a different context. It's patched to make sure that it assigns the right context to the file when it creates it, and everything's fine. So you can do VIPW minus S, edit the shadow file, and there's no problems. You can't do vi/etc/shadow. Of course, on the other hand, if you do vi/etc/shadow, you're bypassing the normal shadow file locking procedures, and you can theoretically cause other problems along the way anyway. So there's probably other benefits to it as well. Another thing, if you're just the initiative role, you can't create device modes at the moment, and you can't directly access block devices. These things are bugs. I've just recently made a change to the policy, which is going to go into Fedora, to enable the administrator to directly access block devices. So you can do dd if=dev/hda, if=whatever. And previously you couldn't do that. And there are a few other things where the administrator can't do quite everything. But mostly, everything you want to do can be done easily. Another question? Yep. Okay. Question is, where are the role passwords stored? The role password is exactly the same as the regular login password. It's all done through PAM. It's the same thing. I think there are methods using PAM where you can use a different password for different services, and you could configure a new role like this. The default configuration is new role uses the same method of authentication as login and SSHD use, and it'll mean etc shadow. But you could change this. Yes? Yes. So the idea is with new role is that if you log in as over the network, you won't be granted a highly privileged role because that means that if the network login process like SSHD was exploited, an attacker would get this privileged data. You force people to log in to use new role to re-authenticate to prove they are who they say they are before they can get a privileged role. Yep. Okay, question is, how portable is SE Linux to non-IE32? Okay, the old SE Linux, that is the SE Linux on 2.2 kernels and the early SE Linux on 2.4 kernels, was IE36 only. There was some small work done on IE64, but that never got released, I think. I ported the old version of SE Linux to ARM to get it running on a HP IPAC device. But apart from that, it was pretty much IE36 only. And the NSA did a release of their code with ARM support, but it was a second-class citizen. With the 2.6 kernel, the code was rewritten because all the people who mattered in the kernel development world didn't like the way SE Linux was initially done. The early version, the first version of Linux Security Modules, LSM, had a LSM system call. And this was a multiplex system call, similar to the socket call system call. So the first parameter was an indication of which security module you want. So each security module had a 32-bit unique ID. And the second parameter was which of the many system calls related to that security module do you want to call? So SE Linux had 52 unique system calls. And each of these had a varying number of parameters from 0 to about 6. And the kernel developers really hated this. Among other things, getting this to work on a architecture like PowerPC 64 or Spark 64, where you have both 32-bit and 64-bit user space, would be apparently a big nightmare. So the kernel guys just said, no way, this code is never getting in the kernel. So the SE Linux code was rewritten, and there are now no SE Linux system calls. All interaction with SE Linux between user space and kernel space is done through /files/proc. So when a process wants to do its own stuff with SE Linux, like say setting the context used for a new file creation, it does that through reading and writing files /proc/self/atter/something. For the system, there is a new file system, SE Linux FS, which is by default mounted on FlashSE Linux, although this can be changed. And that allows the administrator to control the operation of SE Linux. So now, now this has been done, SE Linux is very portable to other architectures. The Gentoo people are doing some good work. They've got it running on PowerPC machines. So you can get it running on, you can run SE Linux on a Power Mac. There are, is still some work to be done on split word size architectures like Spark64 and PowerPC64. There are some concerns. There may be some word size issues in the code. Currently, no one has shown an actual bug, an actual case where the code doesn't work as it is. But there are cases where theoretically some future version could have problems, and there have been some patches going through to fix theoretical problems. So, as far as I'm aware, every architecture should support SE Linux, provided it has a file system that supports Xatarus. Now, unfortunately, HP IPAC machines don't work with SE Linux, because for the flash device they used for the root file system, it supports the JFFS2 file system only, and that has no support for Xatarus. So it's now impossible to label the file system with file types, and therefore won't work. SE Linux will still boost, and you can still do all the stuff, but you can't label a file, so there's really no point. Yes? I could do that, you're right. I could get a compact flash hard drive and put ext2 or ext3 on that, and it would work. But I haven't really felt inclined to spend the extra $500 or $1,000 to get such hardware, and currently no one's paying me to do that, so it hasn't got done. So I just use my IPAC as a handheld organizer instead of an SE Linux development machine. Yes? Okay. Do you want me to show you the policy file or just talk about it? Okay. Is that big enough? Okay, this is the policy for OpenLDAP server. So, the most important line is this one. This defines the base rules for a daemon. So it means that it can be started from the init scripts, which is initrc_t. It can create a PID file in /var/run. The PID file has a derived type, so it doesn't have the same type as other files in /var/run. This means that if you have two daemons start up, they can't mess with each other's PID files. Of course, the first daemon to start up could just take all usable file names in /var/run and do a denial of service attack, which will be annoying. But it limits what can be done in that regard. The daemon can also, of course, fork into the background and do all the other stuff that daemons do. Here we're defining a type for an LDAP port. And in another file, which I'll show you now, okay, this is a... Okay, so this line, it's called M4 macro code, if defined slapd.te, which means if we're using the policy for the LDAP server included, we're defining a port context, PCB port 389, and it's LDAP port T. And this means that when this is assigned, no other daemon can bind to that port. So if, for example, I'm running a broken copy of bind, and someone exploits that, and I say, I want to spoof LDAP. I can't do it. I can't bind to the port. So now we've defined a few other types. We've got a type for configuration files. Notice what attributes here. So this attribute is saying that it's a type for a file. System file means that the administrator can access this file. And usually, you have the system file to almost every file type. The exceptions I mentioned before, ones like shadow underscore t, where you have a particular corner case where it's inconvenient to allow the administrator to access it. But for almost everything else, you want to allow the administrator to do it. So you put this sysadm file attribute, and somewhere else in the policy, there's a rule saying that that sysadm underscore t can have full access to files and directories of this type. Also, of course, because this is an attribute, if I define a second administrative domain with a second type matching it, it would also be granted access to this file. Now we have a type for the LDAP database and a type for the replication log. Now here's the temp domain macro, which I referred to before, for temporary files. This means that when OpenLDAP creates files with /tmp, nothing else can access it. Users can't access it, other daemons can't access it, and it's isolated. This one grants network access. So it can send packets out of the network, receive packets from the network, all the basic network stuff. By default, daemons don't get network access. So that means that if they're exploited locally, they can't be used to send data off-site. You can't use exploits. Well, another thing is, if you have a daemon which has two modes of operation, one for local, one for remote, for example, syslogd, you can't exploit that and make it do network access because the default policy won't allow network access. If you want to configure your syslogd to log over the network, you've got to modify your policy and put in this rule to allow network access. Now we have a few lines just granting the domain access to itself. So it can create a FIFO or a Unix domain socket to talk to itself or to other processes of itself. And this one is necessary if you're doing, for example, LDAP for providing, or if you're doing authentication via LDAP, you want to have this line. So basically it means that domain is a attribute of every process domain. We're saying that any process in the system can talk to the LDAP server by TCP. Now, next section is capabilities. So we're allowing it net raw access. I'm not sure why we did that, so I'll have to review. Net bind service, so it can bind to ports below 1024, and kill. For some reason, you sometimes have a root-owned OpenLDAP server process wanting to kill a child process of itself, which has a different user ID. For killing, we still have a separate set of signal checks, so it can only kill processes in its own domain. So this kill capability doesn't really do much, doesn't end up doing any damage. In the Linux kernel source, include /linux/capability.h. One thing I might do this actually is to write this into a man page and get it included in an appropriate package. Because it's really annoying to me when I'm doing development. One thing I want to do when I'm putting the policy for these capabilities, I always put the capabilities in order. I think it's good to have these things in order. So when you're reading policy, if you're saying, well, does it have DAC override capability? Well, you check the first entry. No, it hasn't. It saves a lot of time when you've got a lot of capabilities. So I'm always checking the includes file to see the order. And it should be in a man page. Also, another thing is that a lot of the capabilities aren't properly documented. Some of these capabilities, they're capable to do wide-ranging things, like sysadmin, and it allows a heap of stuff, and it's not really defined very well what it does, mainly because in every kernel, they change it. 2.6 kernel adds a huge number of new capability checks. So all the things that didn't need capabilities before now need them in 2.6. Most of the time you won't notice this because if you're running a non-S Linux machine, you'll run a process as non-root, so it doesn't have capabilities, and therefore actions get quietly denied, and it just things just do the normal stuff. If you're running a process as root, it has capabilities and it does the stuff, and again, you don't really notice. You're running a machine on 2.6 with SE Linux. You're running a process as root and has a restricted domain and doesn't have the capabilities. So something these things ordered. So one example is sysdash in 2.6 now wants sysadmin capability. Sysadmin capability means ability to just totally screw you. It's such a wide-ranging capability that if you grant to it a process, it might as well be kernel code. And now this is something required by sysdash some of its stuff. Although it seems to work fine without it. So I put in a don't audit rule for that one. Did I see a hand up? Yeah, Beck? Okay. Well, the question was, how do things work when you have boot to run level one? I don't boot to different run levels at all, ever. So, for me, if I'm recovering a machine, which is, I think, what you're asking about, I boot... what exactly does run level one do? Okay. If you're in the administrative mode, or if you can control the boot process, you can. If you've got a development kernel, then you can boot with enforcing equals zero to turn off SE Linux. So basically, it'll just audit things but not enforce them. You can boot with init equals slash bin slash bash, and that'll give you a bash shell running in kernel underscore t context, which can do lots of interesting things. Basically, if they can control your boot sequence, you've lost. You just need to have security on the bootloader. One thing that could potentially be used to alleviate some of these things is something somewhat equivalent to TCPA in a bootloader. I've been talking to a Sun employee recently about such matters and trying to convince him to change the Cobalt Cube and Rack bootloader to have GPG included and check a GPG signature on the file it boots and do other checks if you want to override it, so have a password check or something. And he's generally very much in favour of the idea. The problem is that most Cobalt hardware only has 1 meg of flash for boot stuff, and GPG is about 300k of file size, and that's going to be a bit of an issue. So hopefully we'll get some vendors to do some of this sort of stuff and get a bit better security on some of these things. Of course, if you talk to the NSA guys, they'll say, oh, of course, you can just sniff the bus and see the passwords that go past. But for most of us, I mean, we just assume that if someone is capable of sniffing a memory bus, then one way or another, they're going to get you anyway, so just give up. So we've got a few other questions. Yes? Okay. Your question was about drive types for things like slash bar, slash run, and slash TMP, and with this inheritance relationship. The relationship is there's a macro you can use in the policy. I'll just find you an example. Okay, here's an example of this. So when we create files /etc on boot from the init scripts, which run in init rc underscore t, /etc directory has the type etc underscore t. And so we're going to transition to etc underscore runtime underscore t for class file. So this means, this macro does everything necessary to permit init rc underscore t to write to etc directory for the purpose of creating a file, and that file will then have the type etc underscore runtime underscore t. It will not be permitted to create a Unix domain socket, or a named pipe, or a directory. So that there is no real inheritance relationship. So there is no relationship between etc t and etc runtime t, apart from the fact we have this rule in the policy. So I could change this rule and say, have it create file etc underscore t with foo underscore t, just as easily. It wouldn't make any difference. Apart from the fact that if we didn't have etc runtime underscore t, everything would break. There's a lot of policy that relies on things accessing the mtab file. So there's a huge number of domains that want to have processes that want to see what things are mounted, and they want to read the mtab file. And this means that if you have the mtab file with the wrong type, then a lot of things will break. One problem that we currently have is that if you boot an SELinux machine with a non-SELinux kernel, the shutdown process from the non-SELinux kernel will recreate the mtab file. The mtab file will then have no type. And then when you boot up SELinux, this file has no type, default, so it gets file underscore t, which has almost no access permitted. And then the mount process can't unlink this file. And then remounting root as read-write fails. I've got some ideas of how to fix that. There's about three or four ways I could solve this, and I'm trying to work out which of these three or four slightly nasty things is nice enough that I'll bother doing it. So it's not an insolvable problem. It's something that has to be done. I've sort of gone around your question. Have I answered it enough? Yeah. It's just a drive from rules. So this macro expands out to about 20 different discrete rules. The policy that I have loaded on my laptop has about 100,000 rules. The macros expand to a lot of rules. So a simple one like this. I mean, this is 20 rules or something, and it all expands out to a lot. Another way of having a lot of rules is user domains. If you say, okay, we've got three different classes of users. We've got user role for just regular users. We've got staff role for people who are slightly more privileged, say professors at a university. And we have, PhD underscore R for the postgraduate students. We add this new role, we'll add perhaps 10,000 rules. Okay, do you have more questions? Yes. Okay, sure. Okay, to determine the current role, you just run ID, and ID is in core utils, which is patch for SELinux. So the ID command will by default display the context at the end of the line. So in this case, RJC is my identity. Staff underscore R is my role, and staff underscore T is the domain that I'm running in. Now, to look at the contents of the files, I'll log in as administrator to do this, because if you're a unprivileged user, you can't even stash most of the files that are different types. And I ultimately, directly under my home directory, there's a bunch of files of different types. But I'm even going to show you an ls of my home directory, so I'll have to make do with this. Okay, so Okay, so we've got the temp directory itself, tmp underscore t. Every file or directory on the system has object underscore r as its role. The reason for this is roles do not apply to files or directories. So object underscore r is just a placeholder. In some future version of SE Linux, the role will or may be used. So I found this out when I made a patch some things to just remove it entirely. And the NSA guys really asked me a lot to not do that sort of thing. System underscore u is identity, because it's a file created by the system. Or sorry, directory created by the system. So we've got the root directory, which is root underscore t. Next one, ICE Unix, which is for some type of interprocessor communication used by KDE. So this file was created by my own account when I logged in and run KDE, or sorry, ran Startact, which launched KDE. My identity is RJC when I created the file, so it's on the file. This identity means that I can change the type of the file, because I'm allowed to change the type of staff underscore tmp underscore t, but another user who logs on to the same machine will have a different identity. If they're in the staff role, they're normally permitted to change the type of staff underscore tmp underscore t, but they can't change this directory because it's got my identity on it. For an unprivileged user to change the context of a file, their identity must match the identity of the file. So next we have, that's a mistake, don't worry about that one. This directory is created by the system as part of the startup scripts, and it's got XDM Xserver TMPT, which is just a type used by the Xserver for temporary files, and also for the directory for the X11 Unix directory, which it then allows the Xserver to create Unix domain sockets under it, and for the regular user to access those sockets. Okay. Now, under the X11 Unix directory, when I logged in, I ran startx, and the X server ran under my own identity, and it runs as staff X server T. The general procedure for temporary files is when domain X or domain foo creates a temporary file, then the temporary file name will be foo underscore tmp underscore t. So the staff X server domain created this temporary file, so it's got staff X server TMP type. Okay, well, have I shown you enough of that? At the front, yep. Okay, questions about performance penalties of SE Linux. It's generally very low. If you're doing, for example, disk access, a single seek will take so much time that no matter what SE Linux does, it won't matter at all. You won't even be able to tell if it's in a benchmark. So for a database, you won't know any difference at all. For interprocessor communication and for terminal I.O., there are some differences you can benchmark, and also for some network operations. It can be as high as 5% in some operations, but usually it's much lower. So on average, you might expect perhaps 1 or 2% overhead. If you're a user of a machine, if I just went to your laptop that you're using and put SE Linux without telling you, you wouldn't know the difference from the performance. You wouldn't notice anything. Now, we have a question at the back. Yeah, well, D for directory there. S for a Unix domain socket. Yeah, the Beamer isn't working as well as we'd like to work. Okay, other questions? Yes? Yep. Okay. The way you load the policy, you run, there's a makefile to build the kernel, which checks the versions of all the files and compiles the policy. So in a typical policy, you might have, say, 100 or 200 files used to compile the policy. Then we submit, these files will be concatenated. M4, we run across it to process the macros, produce about a 3 megabyte file. That file will be compiled by a compiler, a policy compiler. The policy, they're actually, if you have, say, 120,000 rules in a policy, which is reasonably typical, you won't have necessarily 120,000 lines of data in the file. Because when you do an allow rule that allows an attribute access, it can expand to many rules. So if I was writing a policy, allow domain, space, domain, some operation, we're allowing every possible domain to access every other possible domain. And so if we've got, say, 100 domains, well, we've got to have 10,000 rules to make that up. So very simple policy rules can expand to a lot of actual policy database. The policy database that's created is the same binary format that's used by the kernel. So it's expanded out to all possible combinations for optimized access. Now, once this database is compiled, it's then loaded into the kernel by just basically writing it into a special file on the SELinux file system. It's binary stuff, and I can't show it to you in any convenient way. Well, I could show you the source code of the program that writes it, but it's not quite that simple. Let's do that afterwards. But I'll show you the format of some of the files it uses. So this is the file that's produced by the M4 macros. So this is a typical sample of the macro code for the staff underscore t domain, which is just a regular user domain. And as you can see, there's a lot of comments there. This is where we define the staff underscore t type. It's a domain. It's a user domain. We've got another attribute, unproved user domain. So in some of the policy, we'll say we want to allow certain access to unprivileged users. So for example, we might say allow the staff underscore t domain to kill all processes for unprivileged users. So we'd use the unprivileged user domain for that. If you want to refer to all domains for users' shells, shell logins, user domains that the alias we use, web client domain is an alias that refers to everything that needs to access the web. I had to create that alias because someone who wants to access web pages, they need to access a local Apache instance, they need to access a web cache such as Squid, and want to access web-based configuration ports for programs as well. So with web client domain, all these daemons that have they're offering web access can just allow TCP connections from web client domain to themselves. However, it may be the case that there is no such daemon loaded. So we have no Apache, no Squid, none of that. Then the policy completion process would just remove this entirely. It would mean nothing. And this rule defines the staff underscore R role and allow the staff underscore T domain to be part of that role. You want to see more? No. The question was, does the password file contain extra users? For a typical SELinux install, you don't have any extra users. You might have the root account being the sysadm underscore r account, and so it's used for administration, and user accounts being used for the regular purpose, so there's no need for extra users. However, because SELinux allows you greater control over what access is granted, you might then make some further decisions and say, okay, now I can control things. I want to allow user A to access some a broader block device and user B to have raw network access, whereas in the past you'd have to grant them both root access to do that. So SE Linux allows you to do more things, and that might make you decide that it's a good idea to have more accounts. It doesn't force you to, though. Okay, I think this is the answer to your question. So in this case, for my account, user RJC is allowed to use roles staff underscore R and sysadm underscore R. Well, okay. When I log in as RJC, I might log in as either staff underscore R role or sysadm underscore R. If I SH in the machine, I'll only be granted a staff underscore R because SH daemon is not permitted to access this role. If I log in the console, I can get a choice. I can configure in different ways. I can configure the login process to ask me which role do I log in to. I can create a configuration file in my home directory which specifies which one will be the default. I think I could specify either of those being the default. Also, I can configure for the login process which one I want to have be the default. I'll show you the configuration file. So this configuration file specifies the role and domain of the login process. So in this case, local login C is for /bin/login. And bin login will check user role and user domain first. Then it will check staff role and staff domain. Then it will check sysadm R and sysadm domain in order. So it means if I have a user that's permitted to use all three of these contexts, they will probably get the user role when they log in. They could, of course, put a dot default context file in their home directory to override this and specify they would prefer sysadm underscore R. That doesn't mean they'll get it. That means that if they're permitted to get it, they will. Now we've got another one, a line for remote login. And this checks user role and staff role. I don't mention sysadm role because the policy doesn't permit a remote login process to do that. If I put sysadm R on this line, it would make no difference at all. The remote login process might try to do it, and then it will just fail. So for SSHD, same thing. Now, here we've got a line for crond, because crond has to run programs on behalf of the user. So for the users, it will try user role, user crond t. So we have a different domain for the crond scripts as to the regular domain. And this might, for example, prohibit X window access. And various other things that a regular user might do, it won't be permitted. Sorry? Yes, actually, I can't remember whether network access is allowed or not. But this is something that you can configure on your own system. So whichever the default is, you can choose it the other way. And we also have a system role for system cron scripts, which have fairly wide access. Okay, question, yes? Okay, the question is how will it scale with lots of different people writing policy? And this is a really hard problem. For a simple level, there's currently work being done on RPM to enable an RPM package to specify in its header SE Linux policy files. So when you install that package, the first thing that RPM will do, it will copy this policy file to the right location under /etc. It will then compile the policy, load it. Hopefully there'll be no errors in compiling. If there's an error in compiling, it would abort the package install. So if there's no errors, then it'll load the policy. It will then install the files from the package, and the file types for the files can be either specified in the RPM package itself or in the file context files. Now, there are situations where things can conflict. For example, I'll show you assertions. in the assert.t file is contains never allow rules. Some things should not be allowed. For example, never allow a domain to this tilde domain means any type that's not a domain. So a domain, if you want a process, cannot transition to something that's not a domain. And this is just for bugs in the policy. So this would be a fairly gross bug in a policy to define a type of thing, a file type, and then allow a domain to transition to it. Such mistakes have been made in the past, even by me. So we put this thing there to catch to prevent future mistakes. When I put this and a couple other similar rules in, I found about 3 mistakes that I made myself for any policy. Now another rule we have is never allow a domain other than insmod or kernel to use the capability sysmodule to load modules. So one problem we might have, if you have an RPM that has a policy file that allows some other domain to load modules, it will just conflict and the policy won't compile. In that case, it would just be a bad policy. It would just be a mistake by the person who made the package. But there could be situations where you could have different valid uses. I'll give you an example. Okay, I can't see it. Okay, so this rule says that if a domain is not one of the file system domains, then we'll never allow it to access a fixed disk device type. So that means if it's not a file system domain, it can't access DevHDA or DevHDC or something. However, there could be situations where you'd have valid policy that requires that. And in this case, we have a conflict between the policies, and you could, of course, define the attribute to another to the domain in question, make it a file system domain, but that might give it some other access you don't need. We're still working on how to solve some of these problems. For the common cases, this won't be a problem to solve. I mean, if we get, say, Oracle produce an Oracle RPM that has Oracle policy, you could define the Oracle underscore T domain to have the FS domain for its raw partition access, allow it to write some files, etc., on disk. It shouldn't be too hard to do. For a more complex policy, there could be some problems. One area that's particularly complex is when you have subdomains of a user's login domain. So when a user logs in, the default domain they'll get is user underscore T. Now, the current policy allows an IRC client to run in user underscore IRC underscore T. So if someone exploits your IRC client, they can't access the files in your home directory. They can't rewrite the .bashrc file to have it send your password over the network or something next time you log in. They can't copy off your the files from your tilde slash .ssh directory. Writing a policy for those subdomains is difficult and could cause problems. One potential problem is when you have file-type auto-trans rules. So we have one rule saying that when process A creates a file in slash TMP, it gets A underscore TMP underscore T. Another rule that says that the same process will use B underscore TMP underscore T. These rules will conflict. It would be possible for the system to determine which type of file to use. These problems are harder ones to solve. Yep. Oh, okay. Question is about controlling access to proc. Usually that's not very hard to do, because usually there's fairly well-defined access. So we have a set of, for proc we have what's called GenFS labels. So it's a way of labeling a file system which has no backing store on disk. So we label files and directories based on their path name in the file system. I'll show you that now. So here are the proc entries. So the default type for anything under the slash proc is proc underscore absurd. So for proc slash proc slash k message, proc k message t, which incidentally has very few access to it. And so we have various rules mapping with these types. We're increasing the number of types all the time, so we'll probably get about another 5 or 6 over the next 6 months. And we can control fairly tightly access to the proc files. One thing that we still can't do quite as much as I would like, controlling access to a process's own files. There are some files the process needs to access to, within its own proc entries, such as, I'll show you. Okay, can you see that? Okay, when a process wants to control its own operations of SE Linux, there are now no SE Linux system calls. So previously, if you wanted to set the context of a file that you're creating, you would use a system call open underscore secure. That doesn't exist anymore. So if you want to create a file under SE Linux with a specified context, you'll write to slash proc slash self plus asher slash fs create the context that you want to use. Then you create a file as normal, and it gets that context if it's permitted to. If the context is not permitted, then the operation will fail. If you want to execute a child process in a specified context, write to the exec file. A question there? Good question. The only issue, there is an issue with single handling, but it's within one process. So these files under slash proc, slash proc slash self, can only be written to by the same process. So you can't have an external process molesting the process and changing things. But of course, if you can trick a process to get a signal at the wrong time, and if the signal handling code then creates a file in a specified context, then there could be a possible race condition, yes. Yes, I believe that for the case of threads, they have per thread entries. I'm not certain about that though, I'll have to do a check. I'll get back to you later, perhaps tomorrow. Over there, yep. Okay, good question. I'll go back to the main talk. I've got okay, when I was working on IPACs, I did some tests on this. The IPAC I was using had 64 megs of RAM. And since then, a 128 meg IPAC has been released, but still not very big compared to a desktop machine. Also, IPACs don't have swap, and that's really constrained to as well. In my test at the time, SE Linux used about 1.3 megs of memory, which was kernel memory, which is non-swappable. So it is effectively the same as removing 1.3 megs of memory from the machine. My laptop now has 384 megs, so it's not really an issue at all. For an iPad, 1.3 megs out of 64, that's a little bit annoying, but it's not unusable. The kernel memory use is dependent on the policy size. So if you create a simple policy, say a policy with 10,000 rules instead of 20, it'll be a lot smaller. For the IPAC, I think I was using a policy, I think the policy I was using for the IPAC had about 30,000 rules. I wrote up the details of this on my paper that I published at in the proceedings of last year's OLS. It's reprinted on my website, and also the OLS site should have a copy. So if you go to the OLS site, download my paper from last year, it has all the details of this, including how much memory is being used by various things. I specify how much is used by the SE Linux kernel code itself without the policy loader, etc. Yep. Yep. Yes. It's not here. Okay, sorry. There's a link from my main Linux page to my wife's how-to on installing this Linux. So if you go to this URL, there's links to pretty much everything you need. If you find something else on this Linux that isn't there, send me an email and I'll add it to it. Okay, more questions? Yep. When you say interact, so you're talking about for correctness or for non-interference with other operations? Well, it's all dependent by the policy. If the policy is right, things won't break. If an application depends on accessing file A and you deny access to file A, it'll break. There are development of policies, an ongoing process. And so it's an ongoing thing. People report bugs of, hey, this program crashes because it wants to do this and it's allowed. And we change the policy to allow it. But generally, the policy is getting pretty good, and there aren't many problems in this regard now. In terms of a more general audit, there are at least three people I know of who've read through the SE Linux kernel code to make sure it does what it's supposed to do and doesn't do things it's not supposed to do, both in terms of just generally make sure the code's good, and also to make sure that no one snuck anything in, because of course a lot of people don't trust the NSA. None of these people have been prepared to put their names to such an audit though, because they don't believe their coding skills are good enough that they could really catch the NSA out if the NSA were trying to trick them. So I mean, they've audited it and they're reasonably confident, but they haven't been wanting to sort of tell everyone about it, so they just tell me. The code in the kernel is very clean and clear code. You don't have to be a great C coder to be able to understand most of the code. But of course, the interactions are somewhat complex. Also, of course, people like Linus have also cast their eye over the code, and presumably Linus wouldn't put the code in the kernel without looking at it at least. Sorry? Yep. Of course, yes. Okay, if I was to give you a shell account on each of the two machines, one machine was an SE Linux machine, the other machine wasn't, for most of what you do, you'll notice no difference at all. You would notice that on the SE Linux machine, you'd run PS and you would see very few processes. Sometimes you would see exactly two processes, PS and Bash. Whereas on the non SE Linux machine, you would see a lot more. There are JS Security and a number of other kernel patches do similar things. So if you use, let's say, an OpenWall or JSSec machine and an SE Linux machine, you wouldn't notice much difference. Well, yes, if you're running the SE Linux policy works pretty well for the common setups. If you're doing something a little less common, like say you've got Apache talking to PostgreSQL, and it's also talking to an LDAP server, etc., then you might find that some of the default policy doesn't do quite what you want. But in those cases, it would only be very simple modifications of policy to do what you want. So like can TCP connect HTTPD underscore C, comma PostgreSQL underscore C. Fairly simple stuff. Okay. For the regular user domain, setuid capability is not allowed. So if a regular user runs a setuid binary that has no special type, then it won't do the security stuff. There are policy for the binaries that are of note, such as SU, Unix underscore CHP, PWD, password, of course, yes, CHFN, sudo, yes. So for these things, there's policy that allows them to change UID, but the regular domain can't. So if there's some random set UID root binary the user finds that you'd forgotten you'd left on there because you installed it 10 years ago and forgot to remove it, then they can run it, but it won't be running as root, so there's no harm to it. Now, I had a question. I think they're working right now on improving the networking support. When SE Linux transitioned from the old SE Linux, which had a .. security directory on the root directory of every file system, to have a database of inodes to types, and which had its own system calls, when it transitioned from this to the new SE Linux, all the networking code was just dropped. Davis Miller thought it all sucked. It was pretty much dropped on the floor and had to be redone from scratch. James Morris, who works for Red Hat, is working on this right now. There's a bunch of code which will go into the next NSA release, and has already been submitted to Linus, I believe. So hopefully the next, so 2.6.2 will have new SE Linux network controls, which will allow more of these things. Eventually the aim is to do things like control access to IP address, etc. So you can bind to a port on IP address 1, not IP address 2, etc. That sort of stuff. Question over there? Are you asking whether about the process for making a change to policy, or the process of getting that change included by the NSA? Okay. If you've got a change to the policy which you believe is a good change and you believe the NSA should have, the best thing to do is email it to me. I'll review it. If it sucks, I'll tell you why. If it doesn't suck, I'll put it in. Often I'll change it, because often the policy that I get is reasonably good, but it's just missing something, or they use a non-standard name for a type switch. So I'll change it as I think is appropriate. Then I'll send it to the NSA guys. And currently I've written, I think, slightly more than half the policy NSA distributes. So once I've accepted the policy change, usually there's not much resistance to getting the NSA to support it. So it can be as little as 2 weeks between you sending a patch to me and the NSA making a new public release that includes it. If you send me a patch within 2 weeks of a release being done, you won't know about this, of course, because they don't tell people in advance, not even me, when they're going to do a release. But if you send a patch within a short period of a release coming up, then you won't get included in the next release. But it can be included in the SourceForge CVS, which is run by the NSA guys too. Question there? If you're creating an RPM with a new version of RPM that hasn't been released yet, then you can... Okay. For Debian, what you can do is put a file, have your package contain a file and pick a location on disk, which is where the default policy is stored, and you can then copy that file to the directory where policy that's being used is, and then have the policy make load command be run. This isn't documented at all, but send me an email and I'll improve the documentation. Yep. Not quite, because by the time I've read through them, the policy files are generally in a fairly good shape. So the NSA guys sort of quickly eyeball my policy that I submit to them to make sure I haven't done anything that I don't like, which takes a lot less time. There is there are still some to get a backlog. At the moment, we've got a backlog of perhaps 5,000-6,000 lines of diffs. But periodically, Guinness AI spend a day or two working on it and get them all merged in. I don't know if you call it a rubber stamp or what, but they do review the stuff, reject the stuff that is bad, accept the stuff that's good. Well, what Debian does is has stuff that I think is good because I do the packages. For Red Hat, even though I'm employed by Red Hat to do policy, I'm not actually doing a package of the policy. So I give Dan Walsh an archive of policies I think is good, and then he may or may not make some changes to that afterwards before it puts in the package. For Debian, I just do what I want. No. One thing that's been asked of the NSA on a couple of occasions is for them to GPG sign their release code. And the last time it was asked on the public mailing list, and Stephen Smalley from the NSA asked, what exactly do you think we should do and how should we do it? And so I sent them a fairly detailed response saying exactly what I think would be required to do this properly. And they didn't respond to the message at all. So we don't know what might happen. I mean, the fact that he asked for more information means that it's not totally out of the question. The problem with the NSA face, of course, is that anything they do with crypto is regarded as meaning something. So, for example, if they use a 4096-bit GPG key, lots of people can go, oh, the NSA have cracked 1024-bit. And, I mean, I got no idea whether they have practice or not, but I mean, this issue is going to have big implications. And so, on the other hand, if the NSA use 1024-bit, people are going to say, "Oh, they want us to use the easy stuff so they can crack it." And so, I mean, whatever happens, people are going to give them a hard time about it. They've got an NSA public affairs office to deal with the press about these sort of things, but it's going to give a lot of people a hard time. I think that's why I haven't done it yet. Maybe they'll do it in the future. We'll see what happens. If a hostile program is to take over your machine, what we want to do is get direct kernel access through one way or another. So as part of the interim steps of getting kernel access, it could be replacing policy files, doing all sorts of other things. Once it has kernel access, it can use a kernel module to hide its presence. It can have a different policy being loaded to the one that's actually on disk. So on disk, would still have the same MD5 checksum, etc. And so you'd be in the same situation as you are when you're owned any other method. That is that if they're good enough, you won't be able to find them very easily. So in that case, signing the policy files doesn't do much good. There are people doing things such as having kernel patches for GPG-signed modules in the kernel. I think that's a waste of time, really. I think that if things are right, then they can't write to /lib/modules anyway, and so you're safe. If things are wrong and they can write to lib modules, they can screw you in so many other ways that it's really game over. So the only way you want to have something signed is for distribution of software. So ideally we'd like to have the NSA sign the files they put on their website, and then my packages upload to Debian, and the packages that Dan Walsh uploads to Red Hat are GPG signed, and then we want to have apt and yum check the signatures and refuse to install if they don't match, and that's all we can do. Useful, I think. Do you have another question? Front? Okay. Yep. Okay. Good question. Okay. First question was for network file system support. The NSA guys, I believe, are now working on NFS support. The current state of play is not very good at all. All NFS files have NFS underscore T type, and you've got to try and access appropriately. The next thing that's being worked on right now by James Morris is to allow a type to be assigned by the mount program. So we have two NFS mount points. We have one being home underscore T, perhaps, and the other being USR underscore T. It's still not very good, but it's slightly better. Eventually, we want to have labels being used over the network via NFS, and that's a later development. Now, the other question was for labeling of TCP connections. The old version of SE Linux had support for label networking, although I think it never worked right. The only comments that it seemed to come out from it was don't use it. It got ripped out because Davis Miller just didn't like the whole framework and the whole idea of where it was being done. James Morris is now re-implementing from scratch similar functionality, so we'll then have labeled TCP connections, etc. And we say, okay, a machine on the same network, if it's got a certain type, can only access these certain ports. This, of course, requires that we have some sort of coherency with policy. If you have a machine with a totally different policy, and the types don't match up, then we can't do this sort of stuff at all. And if you have a machine that's untrusted, then whatever type it says, it's only for its own convenience and doesn't really matter. So it's only work from clusters of machines, and means by the same people. They don't have to have identical policy as such. They need to have coherent policy in things that matter. Yeah, it's a good network, of course. Well, let's talk about integrating this with IPsec. It hasn't been done before, but this is the right way to do it. That's a good idea. We should do things like that, yeah. Well, no. I think I wasn't perhaps clear before. So you have a coherent policy. You have to have one administrator administrating both machines and have them just do the right things. And this, this isn't really hard to do. This has to be just not doing anything stupid, basically. So we... From a lazy person's perspective, you'll use what's in the default policy almost entirely and make only the very smallest changes and therefore be coherent. And you might have user domain on machine A having slightly different abilities to user domain on machine B. But user domain on machine A and machine B will both be mapping to the same thing. You won't have user domain for staff on one machine and user domain for students on another. So in that case, you won't have any problems. Now, there's a question a bit behind you. Yeah? Okay, question is about comparing Trusted BSD to SE Linux. Trusted BSD has, I think, several different security modules it can use, one of which is a ported SE Linux code. Now, in terms of the maturity of the SE Linux code they're using, they haven't submitted any changes upstream to the policy. Now, the thing is, BSD and Linux use different names for device nodes. So the absolute bare minimum needed is to have a patch that entirely changes the device node naming scheme to assign the right types. Now, the fact they haven't submitted a patch means one of two things. Either they haven't done anything serious at all with SE Linux, or they're not being cooperative. I don't know which it is. I don't know. In any case, neither of these things is a positive thing if you want to use SE Linux on BSD. As for the other modules, I really don't know. At the back? When this is running, the log messages go through the kernel logging facility, so they'll be viewable by dmessage. SE Linux controls use of dmessage, so by default, the user domain can't run dmessage. Well, it can run the dmessage program, it doesn't display anything. It also then goes to the kernel logging facility through syslog. KLD does that. And then you do the normal logging stuff. Also with SE Linux, we have types assigned for the logging files. So you want to have a type for the kernel log, which means that most people can't read it. I'll just give you a quick demonstration. Okay, so you can see we've got a few different types views here for the log files. And okay, so we've got the kernel log using the default file logt, which is not readable by most users. Also different types for things such as casing loops for the XDM logs, etc. Okay, the question is, how does SELinux differ from using ACLs on the file system? Firstly, ACLs are only based around UID and GID, whereas SELinux assigns its own domain independently. So you could have multiple domains being used within the same UID. So for example, if I log in as a user, my domain is user underscore t. I run GPG, it's user underscore GPG underscore t. GPG can lock memory when it's being swapped. It's got the set UID capability, so I can change the root user ID for the locking memory, and has other access as well that regular user main doesn't get. Also, you can have one domain being used for a large number of UIDs. So, for example, we've got user domain. University might have 1,000 students in the same user domain. They've all got different user IDs. So it's just different layers doing different things. Yes? Okay, the question is, can I give a non-root UID root capabilities? The answer is no. The way SELinux works, because it's based around the Linux security modules, which would which use an interface defined, or roughly defined by Linux, it cannot permit anything that's denied by Unix permissions. So, for example, if I do chmod 0 on a file I create as a non-root user, I can't access that file, regardless of SELinux permissions. The NSA guys, I think, would prefer it to be different, but Linus made a ruling and said that, okay, all we do is restrict things that are otherwise permitted. Yep? Yes, there are people using it. There's an ISP that I administer in my spare time that's been running SELinux for about a year and a half. Well, actually, there's also a small company that I occasionally help out at, and they're running SELinux as well. There's another ISP in Victoria offering some sort of virtual domain hosting scheme based around SELinux. I'm not sure of the details of that, but it's in use in production. There's, I believe, one test machine at a Dutch ISP that's running SELinux. So, yeah, is that ISP going to have SELinux? Okay. But I mean, maybe in a few months' time we'll have one of the biggest Dutch ISPs running on SELinux. There are people doing some serious work with SELinux, and a lot more people who want to use it. There are a number of companies that I know of that have plans to use SELinux they don't want to talk about. So there are companies who are looking at buying Red Hat Enterprise Linux